Rising anti-Semitism, right-wing extremism wrapped in the American flag, provocative commentators using mass media to sow divisions. When Rachel Maddow set to investigate what was motivating a rise in hate in the United States, she didn't know what she would find. Her research took her back to the years before the Second World War, and what she discovered was a shocking part of American history she never learned in school. Rachel Maddow is the host of the Emmy Award-winning Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC, and her fascinating new book is titled Prequel, An American Fight Against Fascism. Rachel Maddow, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Thank you so much.
You read this book, and it really does give you a sense of deja vu. Did you get that while you were writing it?
Yes, I was starting down a path of research that I didn't know was going to land me here. I was looking at why it is that we've got a resurgence of Holocaust denial and really violent anti-Semitism in the United States right now. I was sort of looking for historical, not antecedents, but really origins for that. And I ended up in the history of pre-World War II American politics, including electoral politics, which ended up brushing up against Nazism in a way that I had never learned in school. I did not know about the Great Sedition Trial. I didn't know about big Nazi propaganda efforts in the United States and the involvement of lots of members of Congress in that. It shocked me, but I got there because I was curious about stuff going on in our day today.
Newman and Rosenfeld, why don't you sit down here and have a nice fascist cup of coffee?
I've got to go invade Poland.
You do?
Yeah, you communists.
All right, see you later.
Say hello to Mr. Chamberlain.
Yeah, right.
Munich. Well, he sold us.
He looks like, I think that's what they fashioned the penguin after on Batman, was Neville Chamberlain.
Poor man.
Is it possible?
Said I, sir.
I've got an umbrella here that'll take care of the little schnifter. Oh, I said it.
Returns, and I'm confident that we will enjoy peace in our time.
Yeah. You know what? It would have been very interesting if we'd just let Hitler have what he wanted.
He was a madman.
No, he wasn't a madman.
You couldn't give him Poland, the Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, and expect him to be satisfied with those. He had his eyes on Alsace-Lorraine.
That's true.
And she was not in any mood to talk to anybody.
Not in any mood to go to the Brechtis Garden and play the eagle with him. Mm. I tell you that.
The big one, Chief?
The big one, Chief. We're going for the big one. We're going up into the eagle's roost now. We're going to look out all over Austria.
I was Hitler's doctor by Dr. Lieutenant Fritz Kraut.
Yes, it's available to you in an exclusive, resilient, rubber-bound printing.
Now, and for the first time, the Schnifter's whole incredible personal and private life is revealed for lots of money by his trusted personal physician and psychiatrist, Dr. Lieutenant Fritz Kraut, an ex-Nazi, writing with medical college frankness and making the most sensational disclosures ever made about any person.
Talk about rotten psychological backgrounds. These terrible confessions, these ghastly self-revelations, every patriot should read this amazing must book.
Yes, if you hate Hitler now, no word yet invented will describe your feelings after you have read...
I was Hitler's doctor!
Yes, through 15 boring years, this mad fiend poured out his psychoanalytical sickness in startling man-to-man conversations with Dr. Lieutenant Kraut. Indeed, most of these authenticated revelations are so affecting, they may not even be mentioned in an advertisement.
Now you too. For only $1.98, you can know as much about their Schnifter as does Dr. Lieutenant Kraut.
Just listen to what ex-Army Specialist K. Arvid Enlid, present president of the Medical Reserve, says in a special preface to this awful book.
As a doctor, I recognize a phenomena described as human, and as such, understandable.
You must read this book.
Rush me my copy. When the policeman arrives at my door, I will pay him $1.98 plus small postage and DOA charges. I understand that I may read the book in his presence, and if not entirely satisfied, I will return it to him at once, no questions asked, and at no additional cost.
You must not miss this fantastic offer.
Hurry!
Before the war ends.
Before the war ends.
Can I ask you just about the time in which this book lands? It comes at a moment when Jews are fearing and seeing a rise in anti-Semitism. And as you watch that, as you watch what's unfolding right now, what's going through your mind?
To me, I feel like it's a little bit of an inkblot test as to what kind of a person you are and what kind of a personality you are. To learn that we have been through something like this before, I think for about half of people, learning that is brings you to despair, and you think, oh, we're just doing this again. We're never going to escape this. I think for the other roughly half of people who look at this, you think, well, once you learn we've been through something like this before, it's heartening because you know that we can get through it and that there are previous experiences with it to learn from. I put myself more in the latter camp. I want to know how previous generations of Americans contended with a violent ultra-right that wanted to do away with our system of government and that was scapegoating minorities and Jews in particular in ways that were really dangerous. I want to know how we beat that back in previous generations. And that ended up being why I wrote the book.
If you spend any time on social media, you will know that social media feeds are filled with anti-Semitic content, Nazi-like references, and worse. You yourself, I know, have taken issue with X or Twitter or whatever it's called now, and Elon Musk and his current incarnation of that social media platform. How do you read the danger that's posed by what's happening on social media as what seems like a relatively new way to spread anti-Jewish hatred?
I think it's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. And it is dangerous for Jews. It is dangerous for the Jewish community in a very direct way. And it is also dangerous for democracy.
Did you realize that back in, I guess, about 1788, there was a vote that went down in the United States of America to determine the national language, and that German lost by one vote from becoming the national language of this country?
Thank goodness that we haven't had the Schmitz, and we don't write for the Schnitz.
I'm glad we don't speak German. I like American.
Yeah. Some of the language that Agnew is speaking these days translates very well into German, if you've
Agnew.
Noticed. Yeah.
Agnew is
that's a pain
name.
In Agnew. You suffer from the Agnew
and
the Agnew.
And the fever.
But here's another little interesting article from Awake, Awake magazine here.
Oh, that's the magazine of Irish death.
Yeah. The American journalist historian William Shearer, during a recent interview, said, I can't do his voice, so you have to just pretend that this is him, "We might be the first people to go fascist by the democratic vote, and that would be something not even the Germans or the Italians did." He was speaking of America. He said, "Hitler never got more than 39% of the vote in a free election, but I think the American people now would vote for almost anything which would put down the so-called peaceniks and the college kids and the blacks. If our affluent society turned into one of hardship," he said, "I think you'd get, by the consent of the people, a very right-wing society and government in which freedom would be greatly restricted. It would be a sort of dictatorship by approval." The author said he'd been astounded that the Germans would give up what might be said to be the equivalent of the American Bill of Rights in return for the law and order that Hitler promised. "Now I'm astounded that an awful lot of middle-of-the-road Americans would give up a lot of the guarantees of the Bill of Rights in return for the promise of law and order."
I have a little secret for you.
Yeah, and for that...
Look, it's not that
simple. I'll vote.
No.
Twice.
I'm not favorably impressed by all you college-trained students who want to use the idea of the 30th in Germany now. It doesn't hold up, and it's intellectually dishonest.
Oh, you mean, I would agree with that. When little Johnny or little Mary takes his first puff of reefer, or of weed, as we call it, he doesn't know that he's ingesting 2-3 micrograms of little Johnny, little Mary, they don't know that the plant, you see, is just a carrier for the active element, which is tetrahydrocannabinol.
I'm shocked
that you should use a name like that to try and make a point in an otherwise civilized discussion.
How about this point, then?
Oh, you
would have got both of them. How did you do that, Hans? They're both on the same microphone.
Oh,
that's terrible.
Very clever fixing.
I just aimed for the RCA.
Got them right in the ohm.
Yeah, give me back. We're going to do a reading of this. David and I are going to do a reading.
You want to do that now or later?
No.
Affecting
voices like this to try and give the feeling that this is a fascist country is intellectually robbery. It's piracy. I will quote the fact.
Yeah.
We have not given away the Bill of Rights.
No.
We have voted away the Bill of Rights in order to obtain a certain measure of peace.
Certain piece of peace, tranquility.
Footlong peace, we call
Footlong
it.
Piece. Swell pizza pizza.
Swell pizza pizza. Yeah. We took that. That cost us eight. Bill writes three and
excuse
Bill
me, please. Would
eight
you billion. Would you hand me one of those hamburgers, please?
Oh, sure.
Oh, thank you. This is named, you know, after Hamburg, a small town in Connecticut.
Well, you sure you wouldn't want a Frankfurter?
No,
could I?
Have you got any of that American knackwurst?
Some of that stuff. After the school of hard knackwurst.
It's
California.
Out in my Toyota.
Right. Yeah, your Toyota?
Yeah.
Oh, you German too? Huh?
Oh yeah.
How come you disguise your voice?
Oh, I go to a famous comedian school.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
I learn how to do other voices.
You're pretty funny. You make me laugh.
Oh yeah.
There's a reason why scapegoating of disfavored minorities, often Jews, sometimes other groups as well, is part of the authoritarian project. What democracy is citizens of all stripes working together to collectively decide through the electoral process what the future of our country is going to be. Once you decide that there is an outgroup that is not only disfavored, but you have conspiracy theories about them, that they're secretly powerful, that they're somehow secretly in control and they're parasites and they're harmful and that they are out to kill everyone else, what that does is it obviously directs violence towards that community, but it also inculcates in every listener the idea that we cannot participate collectively, all of us, in a democracy, because there are some of us who must be outside that process because they are too dangerous. If you tell people that that democracy can't work because some of us aren't worthy of it, ultimately the democratic project fails.
I mean, in part, you talk about this in the book. You say that this is fueling some of the most, you know, powerful human emotions, that love and harmony are all nice and good, but in the end, hate trumps.
Hate is a very powerful motivator, and hate and fear obviously are first cousins. And I think that's why the targeting of minority groups, the targeting of the sort of loud and proud anti-Semitism that we're seeing on the ultra-right right now, and particularly on social media networks that are unregulated, like Mr. Musk's, it's not just in bad taste, right? It means something, and it's part of an overall political project. And my original question for getting into this line of research was, why are we seeing this very old school anti-Semitism surfacing at the same time that we're seeing an ultra-right surface that has armed paramilitary groups, that is denying election results, that has big crushes on foreign authoritarian leaders? Well, it's because those two processes always go together.
Part of this is about the environment, and you see this now, but you saw this as you're doing the research leading up to the Second World War. What was going on in the United States that created a fertile environment for fascism?
In the 30s, you saw, obviously, you know, Weimar Germany becoming Nazi Germany. You saw Benito Mussolini and his fascists take over Italy. France had a very close brush with its own fascist government takeover with the 1934 fascist assault on the French parliament that overthrew the government there, which laid the seeds for the Vichy collaborationist government, once the Nazis invaded. You also saw, even in Britain, the British Union of Fascists, founded in 1932. We just saw democracies failing all over the world and the rise of different forms of authoritarian dictatorship. And those winds blowing through Europe were blowing through North America as well. And it was an international rise in this sort of fascist ideation. And so people who had a bone to pick with democracy, who did feel like we'd be better off with a strongman form of government of some kind, channeled it into either pro-Nazi or sort of Americanized Nazi pro-fascist organizing. And the thing that is, I think, hard to get our heads around now is that it wasn't a fringe movement, that it was the most powerful people in the country, that it was the most famous industrialist, Henry Ford, who is one of the most prolific anti-Semitic propagandists in human history. It wasn't just his personal views. He did more to spread anti-Semitic gory propaganda than literally anybody else has ever done in the English language. Adolf Hitler cited Henry Ford as his inspiration in the 1930s. But you also had the most famous American hero at the time, the man more famous than anybody else in the country except the president, Charles Lindbergh, who was arguing that we needed to side with the Germans in World War II because we were, after all speaking for the white race. So It was a big movement with very powerful, influential people at its helm. And we're facing something very dark and very dangerous today. But if we beat those guys, if those guys are relegated to the sidelines of history by the efforts of Americans in their day, it makes me feel heartened that we can beat back the comparative pikers that we've got to deal with today.
I mean, the other thing was, I mean, and you mentioned, you know, Hitler looking admiringly at the United States. Nazi lawyers looked at the U.S. as an innovator when it came to racist laws, right? There was a lot of admiration that came from that side of the ocean back to the U.S. in terms of what was happening in the U.S. and what they could emulate in their world.
The Nazi Party in 1933 actually sent a legal scholar, sent a lawyer to the University of Arkansas Law School to study American race law, to figure out how it was that America was able to stay above board in the world's estimation while also having a quasi-legal system of second-class citizenship for non-white Americans. They thought that was brilliant, and they would love to not risk the world's opprobrium while also effectively stripping citizenship rights and ultimately even the right to live from Jewish communities and then other communities inside Germany. When they were debating the shape of the Nuremberg laws, which stripped Jews of citizenship in Germany, they were talking about American race law as the basis for doing it.